This is Fuel.
Fuel for thought.
Jet fuel.
Fuel injected.
Fuel for your business.
Hello, I'm your host Keith Smith. Welcome to The Fuel, the new business podcast, brought to you in association with The Advertist, the UK's only independent business development platform for creative marketing and digital agencies. You can find The Advertist at www.theadvertist.com, that's theadvertist.com, or call on 0203 356 3717. Now, we've got a bumper edition of the show this time around with our first two-parter, so strap yourself in for some real brain food. But before we kick off the interview, let's drop in for some words of wisdom from the funniest man on LinkedIn, Mr. Jeremy Davis.
If culture eats strategy for breakfast, then a healthy, integrated marketing and new business culture eats the 80-20 principle for lunch. And then posts a picture of it on Instagram, obviously. The truth is, like everyone else, it took agencies a while to get to grips with social media after initially embracing it with the giddy excitement of a child with a new toy, or more likely these days, a new games console. Whilst it would be a truism to say it's just another channel, the important thing to remember is that it's just another channel and should be approached, as with any other kind of marketing activity, with a clear idea of who the intended audience is. That's why agencies quickly discovered, like the kit man at my son's under-9 football team, that one-size-fits-all doesn't work. Different content suits different channels. Like everyone in the agency world, I'm a strong advocate of social media as a marketing channel for agencies. And in my other life, as an occasional stand-up comedian, it's an equally important way to reach out to new audiences, connect with new gigs, and occasionally test out a new joke or observation that you think might be really cool, and then get depressed and abandon the thing because it didn't get any retweets. Just occasionally, the two channels do intersect. And this should be a salutary warning to any agency looking to promote themselves on social media, because I was distinctly underwhelmed a while back to be described as the funniest man on LinkedIn. Now, that's not a hotly contested title, and I didn't make it onto my biog when I appeared very briefly at the Gilded Balloon in Edinburgh. It's hardly up there with the funniest person on Twitter, the snappiest person on Snapchat, or the most out-of-touch person on MySpace. I suppose you can at least say it's a niche. There is a serious point here, which is that you need to adapt your content to the audience for that particular channel, and that the second funniest man on LinkedIn has a fairly low bar to reach.
Well, if you look at the agencies, for example, that will, you know, a lot of them will be listening here. They, you know, how many of them try and appeal to their customers on an emotional sell? You know, they might create emotional campaigns for their cut, but they won't necessarily try and generate new business for an emotional sell themselves. They'll talk about, you know, we're very collaborative to ways of working, or they'll talk about, you know, we really understand social media, or we've got the right data tools, or we've got this and we've got that. So they're talking about themselves rather than about their customers, and they're talking about tangible things rather than emotive things.
As this podcast has evolved, it's become clear there's a lot to learn about our industry, and I consider myself privileged to speak to some of its biggest and brightest stars. But this show's guest had so much great information for agencies that we decided to break the show up into two parts. During the intermission, a lady will show up with ice creams and Kiora, so you don't have to leave your seat. In this show, I speak to Steve Cheliotis, the man behind the Super Brands and Cool Brands rankings, and he's got some great advice for agencies that work in and around the world of branding, which, as you'll discover, is pretty much anyone. Steve is a wonderfully insightful guy, and it's worth getting his take on what it's going to take to be a big brand builder over the next few years. So let's get cracking on part one of the Fuel podcast featuring Steve Cheliotis of the Center for Brand Analysis. So anyway, all right, well, look, let's just jump in. Just for everybody's information, if you haven't already picked up, my guest this week is Steve Cheliotis, who's the chair of the Center for Brand Analysis, or TCBA.
I'm very excited to do this because it's actually related to part of the creative industry that that actually fascinates me, which is the data side. And I say fascinating because it's an important part of the kind of branding and marketing puzzle, the actual measurable effectiveness of all the creative work. Now, TCBA helps CMOs and brand owners understand how their intellectual property is performing using a wide range of evaluation and strategy tools. And Steve is a brand consultant and regular media commentator for the mainstream media outlets. More than that, he's a recipient of the Global Award for Brand Excellence from the World Brand Congress, recognizing his contribution to the branding industry. So I'm in esteemed company, and I'm very, very pleased to welcome him to our humble little podcast. Welcome, Steve.
Thank you very much. Welcome, indeed.
I hope everybody's...
I feel overwhelmed by that introduction.
Well, it's kind of, I like to tee you up. I mean, there's just to show I've done some research at least, but I hope all you and your loved ones are all doing well, and you're all still in quarantine, are you?
Absolutely, yeah, still in lockdown, going a little stir crazy now, but can't complain really. All healthy and all well. So
good. Well, that's fantastic. Well, long may it last. Anyway, now on the subject of your own sort of personal branding, I just thought we'd bring everybody up to speed with how you got to be in this place. I mean, what path led you to this point?
Oh God! Initially, I got into branding. If you want a reasonably long story at the start of this,
go for it. We have the time.
it was pure serendipity. So I actually did a public relations course at university,
right.
Public relations and communications. And on my placement year, I was meant to go away for a year and work at a company, and I did that. But unfortunately, the company I went to work for went bust after 6 weeks of me being there. And of course, I needed to get a new placement, and most of the opportunities were gone because it was no longer in the timing window. And I happened to go and visit a friend of mine who was on a placement at a PR agency. And that PR agency had a sister agency, which was in branding.
Okay.
And I was waiting for them to finish work late on a Friday. They were working slightly late. And the CEO of the company walked in, saw me in reception at about 7 o'clock in the evening. So was naturally curious and asked who the hell I was. And I said, a friend of my friend. And I was just waiting for a lift down to Bournemouth. And he said, oh, you're a student then. I said, yeah. He said, oh, so you're on placement. Told him the story of my bad luck. And he said, oh, I've got a project for you. I need to interview city analysts about what they think about branding and marketing and whether it should be on the balance sheet and stuff like that. I said, oh, I can do interviews. Yeah, no, I'm good at that. And next week I went in. They'd spent 6 months trying to interview city analysts without much luck, and I managed to get two or three, partly through bribing them with champagne and chocolates and other niceties to give me the real PR style. Exactly. but essentially, you know, that continued for another week, another month.
Yeah.
I stayed there for the year. I then went back and worked there after universities. It was a company called Brand Finance. And that was basically my pathway into both branding and I guess research. So my first research study was trying to understand what equity analysts thought about branding.
Was that productive?
It was a really interesting study, actually. And I kind of still utilize some of the learnings even to this day in terms of the importance of brands in obviously underpinning business success, in understanding
the financial side of things, the financial impact of a brand, basically.
Yeah, and I think even obviously one thing about marketeers, or sometimes thrown at marketeers, is that they don't understand the language of the boardroom and the C-suite,
right.
And the big picture. And in a way, that early grounding at Brand Finance, obviously not just only during the placement year, but afterwards as well, I think really enabled me to see marketing and research and everything as tools to grow the underlying business.
Right.
And so, you know, when I look at data for even if it's for a CMO or brand manager or someone, I'm not just looking at it from a marketing perspective. I'm thinking about the underlying business and,
right,
you know, how do you use that data practically to inform that business's strategy and fuel competitive advantage and growth. So I think that early grounding was really useful from that respect, as I said, I didn't come at research from a pure marketing only perspective. I kind of came at it from a, what does this mean for the business?
Right.
How do we grow this business? How do we enhance shareholder value, et cetera, et cetera. So yeah, interesting start, but purely serendipitous.
Useful because there was no actual qualification for something like that at that stage anyway. So, it's kind of you ploughed your own furrow to a certain extent and sort of created your own expertise as a result of it. I'd say that probably at least 100% of our audience sort of work for, with, or through agencies that specialize in the sort of the world of branding, but teaching you to suck eggs, but I mean, as you probably know, the word branding often gets misused as a kind of a replacement for a company or a service. And I mean, could you just enlighten us as to, I mean, in your view, what's the difference between a brand as opposed to a company or a service?
Well, I think ironically, both a company and a service can both be brands in their own right.
Okay.
I think incredibly, the branding industry has done a bad job at branding, which sounds crazy, but the fact is there is a lot of misunderstanding. There's lots of different perceptions about what a brand is and so forth, you know. Obviously, as most of your listeners will already know, it's certainly not about brand identity. It's not about the logos, the colors, the smells, the trademarkable IP. It's way beyond that.
Right.
And for me, I simply equate it to reputation. Now, I know other practitioners will argue about the nuance between reputation versus brand, but the problem is that kind of intellectual debate is, I think, why so many people don't understand what the hell a brand is. And I think, actually, forget about that nuance. Let's just think about brand as being reputation. So therefore, a service can have a reputation. A specific product can have a reputation. A company can clearly have a reputation. A place, a person. We all have reputations. You know, for me, if you think about brand as reputation, then again, going back almost to the brand finance days,
yep.
Brand is then no longer just a function of marketing. It's not just about campaigns. It's not just about, the aesthetics either. Mm-hmm. It's every single thing a company does or says or doesn't do or say. And therefore, the custodian of the brand is the CEO. It becomes a C-suite board level topic. It's probably the most important thing for any company alongside its people and culture and its products and services. and that's how I see brands. And for me, when I talk to people about brands, I often use Professor Marty Neumeier's definition that a brand is basically a person's gut feeling about a product or service. And that gut feeling stems, as I said, from all the interactions that a person's had with that company.
Right.
And it's built up over time. And those interactions create that gut feeling.
You know, right.
I don't like McDonald's. I love McDonald's.
Right.
You know, and McDonald's, big American horrible corporate. Oh, convenient, reliable food. It's the same everywhere you go. Great.
Yeah, grew up with it sort of thing. Yeah.
Yeah. And there can be loads of different stimulus that has created those different interpretations. But ultimately, that's what the brand is. It lives in those people's minds and those people's feelings and has been created through a complex series of different things, but has been boiled down to a really simple interpretation by those individuals. So as I said, that's how I see it. And therefore, everyone in a business is a brand builder or a brand destroyer. And, you know, when I do talks, I often start by getting people to just kind of turn to the person next to them as you do and talk about a brand they love or hate or a brand they've had a good or bad interaction with. And the diversity of answers. Some people will say, oh, I love, you know, Bisto because I love the classic advertising and the Bisto. And, you know, other people will say, oh, I love this brand because I called them up the other day and they were so responsive and nice. And some people say, oh, I love that brand because I grew up with it. My mum always used to use it. And it brings up, you know, there's so many different things that people can talk about in terms of what made them love or hate the brand. And that's what I mean. It's a really complex thing.
It is, isn't it? And I try and best explain it whenever anybody asks me, which isn't terribly often, but it's kind of like the thing that when you hear a piece of music, the sort of feelings that then come along with that piece of music. And I mean, for one person can hear it and it can mean a completely different thing than to another person. And so there's a whole sense of emotions and senses that sort of get attached to it. And but I mean, most people in our industry or in my industry know you from obviously the sort of cool brands and the super brands sort of identities, which sort of I imagine I was thinking the other day that, you know, sort of if you ever introduce yourself and sort of say, oh yeah, cool brands, super brands, you know, to a brand owner, that you must be like the Michelin man turning up at a restaurant or something.
I wish.
but I mean, it's kind of, as you were saying, on an emotional level, you know, sort of brands kind of sort of add value through influencing emotions and stuff like that. I mean, what would be the best example that you could think of a brand that kind of just does its job properly?
God, I think there's lots of different examples. I mean, what I would say just generally is that, you know, most of the listeners, most of the people working in the industry, we know that emotion works. Okay, there's lots of data from Gallup, from McKinsey, from all kinds of people that show, even Bennett and Fields' work for the IPA, that emotion works, right?
Sure.
We know that because people buy emotively. Right? 90% of our decisions as people is based on system one. It's that fast, intuitive, subconscious thing. We don't sit there rationally going, oh, let me just have a look at lots of different factors and evaluate all the brands against them.
Right.
So, you know, for me, emotion is the most important thing. I'll give you some not necessarily new examples, but ones that hopefully people will know, because then it will hopefully make the point I'm trying to make. If you take Persil, dirt is good. Okay, if they'd have just kept going on in their marketing as our washing powder cleans your clothes, well, how is that different to Ariel? How's that different to Dad's? How's that different to anyone else? You don't create a strong brand or a distinctive brand or a brand that's, you know, stays in the memory by just saying tangible things about what your product does. So by suddenly talking about dirt is good, they were talking to the parents who were buying predominantly the product about the fact that, you know, their kids could go out, they could get dirty, they could play. It's an emotional thing that parents, you know, could connect with.
Right.
But the subliminal message is still, of course, the tangible message. Doesn't really matter if they go and get mud all over them, because it'll get clean with Persil.
Fine.
And so by just bringing in that nuance of emotion and playing with it over a period of time, it just makes them stand out. Or like Dove, Campaign for Real Beauty. Again, they could have easily just harped on about our products moisturize really well and they're pH neutral and et cetera, et cetera. But it's like, well, you're a skincare brand. Of course your products moisturize and of course they don't screw up my skin. That would be crap, wouldn't it? You'd have a crap brand and a crap product. But if you just say that alone, it's like, well, so what? So I think, again, but in this case, Unilever talking about something beyond that and trying to resonate with the buyers on a different level, you know, they haven't always got it right, should be said.
Right.
But by generally talking on a different level, they stand out and they distinguish their brands. And again, great new brands do that as well, like Airbnb. You know, they could easily just go, we've got loads of places everywhere, could talk about functional things. It's really easy to use our app. But instead, they talk about belong anywhere.
Yes.
And, you know, a lot of their campaigns are really emotionally resonating. And I think, again, it just makes you like that brand more. It appeals to your humanity. It stays in your mind. And it just distinguishes you from another brand that might just be talking about something very functional.
Right.
That, let's remember, can almost certainly be copied by everyone else and is probably a category hygiene factor.
Would it be fair to say that that there's just as much chance of someone like Unilever getting it wrong as a new brand sort of coming onto the market? I mean, is there kind of an acquired expertise that comes with it that rookies kind of always make? I mean, how come there are still so many brands that get it wrong, you know, by just putting out a great logo or just putting out, you know, the sort of the obvious elements and thinking that does it?
I think it's partly because people like to play it safe.
Right.
And, you know, if you're saying, hey, our product works, no one's going to say, oh, you can't say that. Whereas if you're coming to it from a totally different angle, there'll be soothsayers that go, oh, I don't like that. Well, that's not going to work. Or, we shouldn't attach to that particular emotion or value or that attitude or that perspective because some people it won't resonate with. And, you know, it goes through kind of layers of risk aversion where someone will go, well, that doesn't work. So I think that's partly it. I think partly, again, it's just everyone gets it in principle, but a lot of people make almost the silly mistake of going, but it doesn't apply to us. You know, I've been in so many rooms where people, I've talked about this kind of thing, and they go, yeah, no, absolutely. You know, boards of directors, well, we get that. Absolutely, that works. Of course, you know, I bought this Rolex, not because it can tell the time, because my £5 Casio could tell the time as well, accurately. I bought it because I just wanted that Rolex, and it makes me feel good and makes me feel like I've achieved and all those other emotional things that that purchase might have created.
Right.
They get it, but then they'll turn around and say, oh, but it doesn't apply to us. You know, we're a considered purchase, and you know, or we're in B2B. I mean, God, you know, someone's making a B2B purchase, they're able to switch off their humanity and make a decision based purely on some black and white stuff that's written down on a paper, and they've evaluated everything carefully, and we've got to push this other so they intuitively get it, but then it's almost like somehow they go, but that's, you know, and I still think it comes down to risk. They go, yeah, but that's not for us. Let's play it safe. Let's talk about the qualities of our product or what we do. Well, if you look at the agencies, for example, that will, you know, a lot of them will be listening here. They, you know, how many of them try and appeal to their customers on an emotional sell? You know, they might create emotional campaigns for their but they won't necessarily try and generate new business through an emotional sell themselves. They'll talk about, you know, we're very collaborative to ways of working, or they'll talk about, you know, we really understand social media, or we've got the right data tools, or we've got this and we've got that. So they're talking about themselves rather than about their customers, and they're talking about tangible things rather than emotive things. And therefore, surely they're saying exactly the same thing as all the other agencies are saying. And
yes.
So that I think, as I said, if we fall into it as agencies, and many of the agencies understand this, then it's no surprise that our clients are also defaulting to, well, let's just talk about our product. Let's talk about how good it is. Let's talk about what it does. Let's talk about, you know. And as I said, I think it's a balancing act. It's not to say you just have emotion. You know, clearly you've got to tick other boxes as well. I tell you what, the simplest example I can give you is house buying.
Okay.
If you're buying a house, you will probably look at tangible stuff. How far is it from the nearest transport? If you've got kids, what are the local schools like?
Mm-hmm.
What's the crime around here? Is there a park nearby? You know, you're looking at tangible things as part of your deliberation. But ultimately, you walk into a house that you might buy, and within a few seconds, you go, yep,
mm-hmm.
or no, I'm not buying this house, or yeah, I love this house. And it's based on a whole lot of subconscious stuff, and it's probably silly things like the shape of the door or some of the decor or whatever it might be, even though you know you're going to rip it up and do it up. There's something that's triggered an emotion that's made you go, I feel good here. This is a good vibe.
It's usually bakery for me if somebody's baking something.
Yeah, exactly. Nice little tricks. But, you know, it's more people will have bought a house that's probably not convenient for them, logically, because they'd like the vibe of it.
Right.
Bought a house they've walked into and didn't like the vibe of it because it's close to the train station or,
wow.
or whatever other tangible factor there is. And it's kind of like that. With brands in some ways, in that, you know, we might justify buying the Merc because of the boot space or the amount of gallons per mile or whatever, but we probably already made the decision that I just want to buy a Merc. And that's why I guess campaigns that can play on emotion and can appeal to our emotion and make us go, that's for me,
Right.
You know, whatever reason that is, it excites us. It gives us a feeling of contentment and security. Whatever the emotion is, it's not always the same emotion.
Right.
It's the one that can speak to us emotionally that makes us go, that's the brand for me.
Right, yeah.
And I've kind of made that decision. And now I need to justify it. And yeah, I need to look at the tangible stuff.
The confirmation bias almost.
Exactly.
Just looking for, exactly looking for that. Yeah, things that justify why I've made that choice. With regards to the company's employees and the workers within a company, what's the correlation between the kind of internal and external sort of stakeholders and brand reputation? How does that sort of play off?
God, I think it's so important in this day and age. You know, we talk a lot about authenticity and obviously brands' values and purpose are becoming more and more paramount and so forth. So if what you're saying in your marketing doesn't align with how your employees are behaving and acting, it ain't going to work very well.
Right.
And equally, you know, I think if your employees are dissatisfied and they're going home and going, God, that place is horrible, that spreads. And you end up with this kind of conflict between the internal and the external brand, really. So I think it's really important. I'll give you a very quick story and then I might tell you about a particular model that people could think about.
Yes, yes.
The very, very quick story is that I went into a Timberland shop here in London on Regent Street a few years ago. I've told this story to so many people, by the way, so I'm afraid this isn't fresh. But I think
it's new to me, so go right ahead.
Already been somewhere else, walked into the shop, bought a T-shirt. So it wasn't a pair of boots, just bought a T-shirt. Guy said, when I was buying it, paying for it, said, do you want a bag? And I said, no, I've got a bag here. I'll just put it in there. And he said, oh, I'll have a bag anyway. And I said, no, think about the environment. And he said, oh, that's bull. So don't worry about that. And literally behind him on the wall, behind the sort of counter, was some of Timberland's values, one of which was sustainability. So I'm sitting there looking at a massive word of sustainability on the wall whilst the guy serving me, representing the brand, is like, just have another bag. What difference will it make? All that sustainability stuff is bull. Now, I've never been back to that shop. I've never bought anything further from that brand. And as I said, I've told this story quite a lot. So if you're not hiring by values, if you're not aligning what your purpose and values are with your people, then it ain't going to work. So I think it's really important. And as I said, just going on to a specific model that might be useful to people, I've worked with a lady called Sheila Parry, who's worked in sort of internal comms culture space for a long time. We've produced a diagnostic which helps people understand their sort of internal brand equity, if you like, and also how it aligns to how maybe the brand is seen externally. And you don't necessarily even have to use us for it. You can still take the five buckets that I'm going to quickly talk about. Okay, so if you think about pride, it's an anagram, of course. So P is for purpose. So, you know, do your employees understand your purpose, as I've just said with the Timberland example? Do they get your values? Do they live them and so on? R is the reputation. So how do they feel about your reputation? You know, the whole sort of almost the business card test. Like, are they proud to give out their business card when we used to give out business cards? Or are they like, I'm so sorry, I work for this company, you know, almost apologetic when they tell their friends who they work for. But that whole reputation, how do they feel about it? And, you know, then you've got essentially integrity. So does the company really deliver on its promises? So what do the staff feel about, you know, listening to customers, innovating based on what the customers need, delivering good customer service, all of those kind of things. Then you've got direction. So where is this business going? And not only where's this business going, but what's my part in this business? How do I fit in? What's my direction within this business? And then finally, energy. So what is the momentum here? What is the, you know, the energy here? You know, and that all equates to things like well-being as well and stuff like that. But fundamentally, do I come in on a Monday and there's a good positive vibe and everyone's happy to be here? And if you think about those five things, both from an employee perspective, but also from a company perspective, and you measure those effectively, you can understand how people feel within the business. And as I said, that will affect things like advocacy, productivity, how easy it is to recruit people, retain people, and so on. But also you can use tools like that to make sure that, as I said, what you're saying on the outside is also true on the inside.
Right. So, I mean, are you with this Pride model? I mean, is this something that would appeal ostensibly to internal communications people? I mean, to the HR departments and the employee communications people?
Well, I mean, we sort of pitch it to both, well, obviously the C-suite again, because it's important to the whole company.
Of course.
But really, if you think about the internal brand, internal culture, internal feelings and so forth, generally it's a joint, it should be, in enlightened companies, a joint ownership between marketing and HR.
Right.
It's not just a HR issue, it's a marketing issue as well. Because as I said, if everyone internally is feeling bad, or they don't align with the values and the purpose, that will impact how people on the outside see it. I'll give you a very simple example. We did some work for a particular university, and we found that people on the outside were generally quite positive about the university and what it was doing and the quality of its courses and its teaching and so forth. But a lot of people internally weren't. They were going, oh, it's rubbish here. It's bloody, you know, we're not doing good enough. It's too slow. You know, the quality of what we're doing isn't great and so forth. And what we then found is many of the students were starting to reference that and say, well, I thought it was great, but then I was starting to get the vibe from some of the lecturers and some of the support staff that maybe it's not great. And now I'm starting to question it. And now I'm not starting to feel as positive as I was. So you had this transference of negativity internally to externally that was starting to impact the external brand.
Wow.
So again, it's all kind of interconnected. If things aren't aligned from top to bottom within an organization, and internal and external isn't aligned, you're going to eventually have a problem. And we've seen, you know, if we take UK examples, we've seen brands like Sports Direct, for example, have lots of internal issues, which are now plaguing how they're perceived externally, whether that's by consumers or indeed other stakeholders like government. So, you know, these things, particularly with transparency, social media, disgruntled employees jumping onto, you know, review sites that, you know, that you can't isolate internal and external.
No.
But as I said, as things like purpose and so forth also become more important, you've really got to align your internal and external as well. And as I said, these kind of tools should be shared by marketing and HR. They've both got a vested interest in getting this right for the success of the business and for their brands.
Fantastic. Well, that's very useful, Stephen. Thank you very much. I mean, I think that there's a massive takeaway there as well. And I mean, obviously, sort of given where we are now in terms of the economy, I think it's useful to be able to, for agencies to be able to look at kind of new areas to that will be challenging businesses in the future. And that is definitely one to think about. Just circling back slightly onto the cool brands and super brands rankings. I was just reading them earlier, and I seen, obviously, you know, companies like Amazon feature so heavily on both of them. But obviously, you've got things like the German discount sort of discount supermarkets like Aldi, Lidl, sort of coming through. Given the new environment that we're all facing, and what effects of something like a global pandemic going to have on kind of influencing the rankings of these brands? I mean, is this going to shuffle the pack slightly?
Well, I think in terms of the rankings themselves, they tend to be quite slow moving. So you're right. You know, the Audis, the Lidls, the things like that, they sort of have been rising steadily for a number of years. But of course, because those rankings are overall sentiment rankings, people still kind of go, oh, I love M&S, I don't necessarily shop there as much, but they go, yeah, it's a great brand. Yeah, you know, I love it, and so forth. So in a way, the rankings, you know, tend to move quite slowly. And that's why we also introduce things like the relevancy index, which tend to be more indicative of where a company is now, as opposed to overall brand sentiment. So someone like Amazon performs much stronger in the relevancy index than, say, the core super brands index. What I'd say beyond the index, if you like, is that what we've seen with the current COVID-19 crisis is an acceleration of the trends that we already saw. So brands that were struggling, that were maybe dying by a thousand cuts, have suddenly had their arms and legs chopped off. Brands that were growing are suddenly, you know, actually sprinting in terms of their growth. So take a simple example on fashion retail. You know, Boohoo was doing well before the crisis. Now it's doing even better. Accessorize, or, you know, some of the brands Boohoo's just bought, like Oasis and Warehouse, were doing poorly before the crisis. Now they're doing terribly. So in a way, it shifted those changes that were already happening. And naturally, brands that have acted as, you know, disintermediators, that have been more tech focused and so forth, that were already growing, are growing quicker. So we mentioned Airbnb, for example.
Yes. Yeah.
I know we can't particularly use it right now, but I'm sure that when we can, they will obviously, particularly with the demise of certain other travel firms, they will grow even quicker than they were beforehand. Or take things like we were talking about housing, Rightmove. Auto Trader, things like that. Those kind of brands that are tech-led utilities, I think will grow and grow even quicker than they were. You'll also have the rise of a lot of subscription-based brands and online, again, sort of delivery brands. So that could be HelloFresh. Food delivery could be Naked Wines. And I think, you know, all of those things were happening anyway, as I said. People were more and more thinking, well, I don't need to go to a car showroom and get it delivered. I don't actually need to go to the supermarket and spend ages looking through the wine rack in the supermarket. I can get, you know, tailored offers to me, you know, through an online service. They can get to know me and deliver me the kind of wines that I might like, all from just sitting at home. You know, all of these things, the personalization, the tech-led things, the efficiency, they were all happening anyway. But as I said, I think they've just simply been accelerated. And of course, you know, there are sub things that have happened. You know, the return of people looking for trusted brands. You've seen brands like the New York Times or the Guardian suddenly doing a lot better than they maybe were before. You know, there's lots of sort of soft trends that are happening. Brands that are offering personalization, as I said, could be Spotify, could be as simple as Netflix, but also brands like Function, which is a hair product brand, where you answer lots of questions about your hair, and then they create a tailored product specifically for your hair, and again they mail it out to you on a subscription basis. So I think there are lots of trends that are accelerating, and lots of winners and therefore losers out of that. The one thing I would say is we do also have to taper our excitement sometimes too. With the rise of online fashion, Primark is still not going to die. We saw as soon as the lockdown ended, there were massive queues for Primark.
Yes.
You know, in the same way as, you know, TV didn't signal the death of radio didn't, you know, streaming didn't signal the death of TV, even normal TV, if you like, live TV. You know, there are sort of trends that are happening, but we have to be careful that we don't live in certain bubbles and think that every single consumer is buying organic delivery food, and everyone is using Airbnb, and, you know, everyone is spending on more premium sort of eco-friendly brands. And so, you know, we've just got to be careful to understand what's a trend and where a growth market is versus what is going to be as everyone keeps saying, the new normal.
Well, I mean, if I can quote your own words back to you, I mean, it was only in April that you actually said, I mean, this was before this all happened, I take it, that in unsettled times, businesses that are well regarded and possess a positive reputation benefit from competitive advantage over weaker branded rivals, providing greater immunity against short-term market volatility. And I think that statement has been borne out over the following couple of months, given what happened, is that you can pretty much take your words and put them against certain brands that have done extremely well, managed to cope with the crisis, as opposed to those that basically stood there and said, well, you know, we can't do anything, and just, you know, and took it on the chin.
Yeah, I mean, I think the point of building a strong brand, again, coming to it from a business perspective, is that it gives you a certain amount of immunity to short-term challenges.
Yeah.
Because you have higher loyalty, you know, you have greater demand, you have probably a larger customer base and so forth. You've got more trust, et cetera, et cetera. You're given a period of time to adapt. And you're also forgiven for certain mistakes. Again, if emotively you're held high in people's hearts and you've got that emotional connection and people believe in your brand. So, you know, I think strong brands that were doing well before the crisis, say, are probably stronger. Those that were already suffering and dying are now perishing quite quickly, unfortunately.
Right.
And as I said, some of those are fueled by bigger trends like technology adaptation and you know, the sort of re-emergence of subscription-based services and so on and so forth. But fundamentally, I think the very strongest brands will come out of this well, alongside a new series of interesting challenger brands that will become the super brands of the future.
Lovely. Well, that's sort of, and we'll touch on that a little bit later on as well. I want to come back to that, but for now, if we could just switch focus just a little bit into the B2B world, and sort of talk about the kind of rising stars in that market. I mean, last year, obviously, you saw the old rivals Apple and Microsoft vying for the top slot, and PayPal still slowly hanging in there, but which seems like, that's the crazy thing, PayPal seems like an old brand now, and you know, and it's not that old at all, and it's still innovating. I mean, that's the weird thing about it. But I mean, recently in the sort of B2B world specifically, we've got brands like Zoom, Salesforce, HubSpot, which are becoming kind of pretty vital to everybody that I know working from home. And a little plug for my own guys, 8x8, who do a fantastic service as well. Do you think that these kind of new brands, the Zooms, the Salesforces, etc., do you think they've got the longevity to, you know, in the rankings? And do you think they'll be able? Do you think they'll still be there in, you know, in 5-10 years' time? And what's going to be their challenges?
Well, I think in most cases, the simple answer is yes. But again, it just needs to be, I guess, tempered a little bit by, again, not getting too excited. You know, take Zoom as a really obvious example.
Right? Sure.
Obviously, huge uplift in the number of people using Zoom during this sort of lockdown that's happened globally at different stages. Will a large proportion of the people that have now used Zoom during this period continue to use it? Yes. Will they probably use it as much as they have over the last, say, in the UK, 12 weeks? No. So I think, you know, they will be a part of the B2B ecosystem because, again, they provide utility.
Right.
They help businesses work efficiently and effectively, and so therefore they are important value based businesses that are useful. So I think they will be around, I think they will continue to grow, but as I said, I think the acceleration pattern will not be like it is now. And again, coming back to the point I made a bit before about not getting too excited about a trend, you know, what's happened with the crisis is it's temporarily accelerated trends are already happening. So home working. In a lot of industries, home working has been steadily growing for a period of time. It will grow as a result of what has happened recently. Lots of businesses have suddenly gone, oh, actually, this really does work on a bigger scale. Lots of people have gone, actually, I quite like working from home.
Right.
But at the same time, you're seeing certain articles and forecasters going, oh, it's the death of the office. What are those big skyscrapers in the sea? You're going to be empty. You're going to have to knock them down or something. It's like, no. Mm-hmm. There's a balancing act between these things. So, yes, we will Zoom more. Yes, we will sit there and think, hold on, do I need to jump on a plane to Chicago to have that meeting, or could we just do it via Zoom? Of course those things will happen, and they'll be driven partly by, as I say, efficiency, economics, and so forth. But we shouldn't sort of overplay the fact that everyone's going to be working from home remotely on Zoom 24/7, and no one will have an accountant. We'll all be using, you know, some clever online accounting system and so on and so forth. Those brands will rise, but there is a certain ceiling. That's my point.
So it's never a binary choice. It's never this or that. It's just a mixture of this and that.
I think so, yeah. And as I said, I think the problem is that if people see something happening and they extrapolate it too far in a way. And I think you've got to take a longer term picture and balancing out, because every trend has a counter trend and that trend has a counter trend and so forth. So, mm-hmm. You know, the rise of people saying it's convenient to work from home will happen. The rise of people saying, actually, it's not great for the planet for me to jump on a plane to the other side of the world. That will happen. But equally, people will start going, actually, I'm going a bit mental working from home all the time. I'd like to start going into an office more. But it will happen, because that's always what happens. Trends have counter trends. And, you know, what eventually happens is it balances out. So even if you take my little snippet a minute ago around the, you know, TV didn't kill radio, you know, streaming didn't kill TV and so forth. You have something new come in, and you have earlier adaptation, and then that grows and so forth. Now, some of those kind of lines have been changed during not only this particular crisis, but just generally with technology acceleration and so forth. Some of those traditional kind of adaptation lines and so forth have shifted from what they used to typically be. But ultimately, the basis of those kind of lines still applies. You will have early adopters, you will have wider adaptation in the market and so forth, and then things will balance out. You'll have a balance out of people that like to work in the office, like to go into the office. You'll have a balance of, you know, what the balance is between working from home and working from the office. And so, therefore, those brands that provide services that relate to those trends will also balance out.
Right.
In my view, you know, as opposed to the extreme version of the office is dead versus this is all temporary, we'll all be back in the office in 6 months' time. It'll be a mixture.
We're going to leave the interview there for now. I hate to cut Steve off in his prime, but he's got such a wealth of great insight for brands. We thought it's best to allow for a breakout session, compose ourselves, and then come back in refreshed with a hot cup of tea. So join us on the other side for part two of the Fuel podcast. Meet Steve Chelliotis of the Centre for Brand Analysis. So thanks for listening. Thank you to our lovely team, especially co-producer Donna, IT Yoda Matt Smith, and Barney and Peter Banks for the music. Stay tuned for more adventures in podcasting brought to you by The Fuel, the new business podcast, in association with The Advertist, the new business development platform for the new business curious. And really, shouldn't that include you?